Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, October 24. Each Sunday when I pull out the television guide for the week, there's only one program I look for, PBS Frontline, to see what the topic is. When it comes to covering financial issues as well as geopolitics, no one does it better. I noted that the week's episode was titled The Warning, though didn't explore further to find out exactly what this was about, only ripped out the schedule and put it on the desk at home as a reminder. So I'm watching the Angels-Yankees game on Tuesday when 9 p.m. rolls around and I flip on Frontline and was mesmerized the next hour. Have to admit, I thus missed the horrible umpiring calls in innings 3 and 4 as it turned out, but saw them later. But I'm giving you all a homework assignment. You can watch The Warning on PBS.org. I guarantee one thing, it will make your blood boil. It's the story of Brooksley Bourne, chairman of the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, from 1996 to 99. A brilliant lawyer, Miss Bourne, was playing in a man's game and she paid for this. I was aware of the issues with the CFTC from this era, but had forgotten many of the details. Basically, Ms. Bourne and her staff became increasingly concerned over the unregulated derivatives market and the threat it posed to our system. Bourne sought to regulate it and drafted language to effort this. That's when she hit a multidimensional roadblock, led by the troika of Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, and Rubin's deputy Lawrence Summers. These three, who all refused to talk to Frontline while everyone else involved in the issue did, including Ms. Bourne, felt that the free market would take care of any problems, with Greenspan in particular believing fraud, for one, need not be regulated or policed because the market would sort it all out. It was the go-go 90s of the Clinton administration, the heyday of financial deregulation, a fact many conveniently forget these days, especially in the last 2 years of Clinton's presidency. Yet Bourne knew of the dangers with derivatives, and so she sought transparency in a market where virtually none existed. But when Brooksley Bourne drafted her regulations and submitted them to Treasury and the Federal Reserve, Greenspan, Rubin, and Summers, and later Congress, had a fit. Summers, who played the role of henchman, was sent over to rough up Bourne, while Frontline has terrific footage of the congressional hearings and the likes of Senator Phil Graham grilling her for daring to question the free market. Then, in the summer of 1998, long-term capital management implodes. LTCM was, of course, unregulated. Bourne had been fighting to regulate these very kinds of operations. LTCM almost took the system down. You'd think Bourne's point had been made. Instead, the Gang of Three and Congress only hardened their resistance. Brooksley Bourne resigned in 1999. 10 years later, we're suffering the consequences and will be for years to come. Many will never recover because of the arrogance of some of our leaders. To say the Frontline program was timely is an understatement. Though I wonder how many in Congress, for one, saw it. Then again, many in that institution would have sat in front of the tube for an hour with Homer Simpson-like eyes glazing over, but I digress. So we fast forward to today and have the same contentious issues, such as in how to regulate the financial markets and risk, plus an offshoot of this, executive compensation. Let me say up front that I want these securities markets regulated to the hilt, and I won't even add the wimpy caveat within reason. We've been a nation of idiots on so many levels, and it's time for it to stop. This doesn't mean I'm against free markets. I'm for fair markets, and I'm for markets where no one individual or a mere handful can game and or take down the system. You can't stop all bad behavior, but America's capital markets can do better than being but another casino in Vegas or Macau. On executive pay, to those who are crying in their Dom Perignon, spare me. I heartily concur with what Paysar Kenneth Feinberg did to the top 175 executives at the seven companies receiving federal aid in slashing their compensation, though a careful reading reveals some are nonetheless making it like bandits, including from the likes of AIG, Citigroup, Bank of America, and General Motors. As the Wall Street Journal editorialized on Friday, these companies and executives, quote, owe their survival to political intervention, and the price of such taxpayer help is inevitably some populist retribution, close quote. But then the Journal expresses the common sentiment of the week that, quote, the danger is that these pay limits will drive the most talented people at these firms to other companies without such onerous pay limits, close quote. Oh, please. When are we going to wake up and understand that you can count on two hands the irreplaceable people on Wall Street? Plus the good ones, say the rainmakers, have been jumping around long before the current crisis anyway. It's the nature of the business, like free agency in baseball. As to fears, the Federal Reserve is now going to heavily interject itself into the pay game, which it said it would now do in terms of issuing guidelines. Don't worry. This means some executives will receive more of their compensation in stock, as will definitely be the case from here on. Good. But no one has to worry that suddenly executive pay for the CEO of non-TARP firms is going from $15 million to $400,000. I hear the cries of socialism, and the likes of Chuck Schumer need to vent from time to time to secure their base, but this is one issue I will not lose a wink of sleep over. What should keep us all awake, though, is the issue of too big to fail. The likes of former Fed chairman and now Obama advisor, unfortunately little used advisor, Paul Volcker, and Bank of England Governor Mervyn King are calling for a split up of the larger banks, especially in terms of breaking out risky trading activities from the part that is accepting guaranteed deposits, or more simply put, a division between investment and commercial banking. As Mr. King said, "Why were banks willing to take risks that proved so damaging both to themselves and the rest of the economy? One of the key reasons is that the incentives to manage risk and to increase leverage were distorted by the implicit support or guarantee provided by government to creditors of banks that were seen as too important to fail." Mervyn King adds, "Such banks could raise funding more cheaply and expand faster than other institutions. They had less incentive than others to guard against tail risk. Banks and their creditors knew that if they were sufficiently important to the economy or the rest of the financial system, and things went wrong, the government will always stand behind them, and they were right." As Volcker has been saying, with few in the White House seeming to listen, break up the banks and let the risky side fail when it screws up. Martin Wolf, Financial Times, "We must not get diverted by the financial sector's opposition or by populist rage. We must focus instead on the core issue. Trying to make financial systems safer has made them more perilous. Today, as a result, neither market discipline nor regulation is effective. There is a danger, therefore, that this rescue will lead to still greater risk-taking and an even worse crisis at some point in the not-too-distant future. Either we impose a credible threat of bankruptcy, or institutions we have to support are made safer, or better, we have both of these. Open-ended insurance of weakly regulated institutions that take complex gambles is intolerable. We dare not return to business as usual. It is as simple and brutal as that." That was Martin Wolf of the Financial Times. I'd add it's also simple and brutal to say that there is as large a disjunction as I can recall in the recent return to good fortune for many in the financial sector and the fortunes of the American middle class, said one. On Wall Street, one hears talk of a return to profitability, the end of recession, and the need for exit strategies. I can assure you that on Main Street, with still rising unemployment, it is a very different conversation. So who said that? Why, if it isn't that old SOB Lawrence Summers, still working in the shadows, though this time as President Obama's economic advisor. But does this mean he now gets it? We'll know by year-end as administration policy, as well as treasuries and the feds, on issues such as regulation and too big to fail is finalized. Regardless of the outcome, though, don't look for Larry to apologize to Brooksley Bourne. I know she's not waiting by the phone. Speaking of the real world, Main Street. 43 states reported job losses in September, while only 7 gained jobs, according to the Labor Department, but the figures are deceiving. Ohio, for one, saw its unemployment rate drop to 10.1% from 10.8% in August and 11.2% in July, so there's cause for optimism, right? Wrong. The improvement is from discouraged workers leaving the workforce. By now, you all know the figures. The official unemployment rate that I have to admit I didn't think would hit 10% is now 9.8%. But the real jobless figure, when taking into account workers such as the example in Ohio, is closer to 16-17%. For the life of me, I don't see how some can be optimistic the Christmas shopping season is going to be a solid one. This was a fascinating week on Wall Street. I jotted down 19 companies whose earnings I deemed important, and 18 of the 19 exceeded expectations, some by a huge margin. The only one falling short, Boeing has so many issues these days that it was hardly a surprise they fell short. But while the likes of Apple and Amazon knocked the cover off the ball and gave solid forecasts for future growth, and Texas Instruments said it saw strong demand across all business segments, You also had just so-so at best outlooks from key players such as UPS and McDonald's. And take Caterpillar. They said, quote, "The third quarter marked a low point for sales and revenues in what has been the toughest recession since the 1930s. But we are seeing encouraging signs that indicate a recovery may be underway." Close quote. Then you realize they're really just talking China and India. The banks and credit card companies have a pretty uniform message. There's a better tone in the credit markets in terms of loan losses, but an improvement in credit quality, as American Express talked about, doesn't mean increased consumer spending, which is what we all want to see. Warren Buffett talked of the, quote, enormous progress that has been made over the past year, and he's right, but any improvement in the labor market will take time, he hastened to add, to which I'd say, again, that hardly means we have a healthy consumer in the interim. And it's not as if those who are employed are seeing wage gains. Many are, in fact, having their pay cut. And regarding these too-big-to-fail banks, analyst Dick Bove got some press for saying the worst was not necessarily over with Wells Fargo, which reported stellar earnings, because of future loan losses, Bove pointing to the housing sector in particular and Wells' exposure to same. That's pretty much the case across the board with the big boys. Many really haven't begun to realize some of their losses, hoping the market or government would bail them out before they had to recognize them. Bottom line, there's still too much uncertainty as I slowly feel my way to a forecast for 2010, which to date I've refused to speculate on. For the week, stocks registered small losses, mostly as a result of Friday's minor sell-off, despite a $25 rise in Amazon's share price, 27%. The Dow Jones once again finished just below 10,000, 99.72, off a mere 0.2%, while the S&P 500 lost 0.7% and NASDAQ 0.1%, just 2 points in this last case. We have another barrage of earnings reports this coming week, plus the first look at third quarter GDP and further data on housing. But while 80% of the companies reporting thus far in the S&P 500 have exceeded their profit forecast, this quarter will still represent a record 8 straight quarters of declines. Lastly, just a note on H1N1, it continues to spread, but I see zero signs that it's impacting commerce, which was my primary fear going back to last spring, such as in a disaster scenario where the airlines shut down. Nonetheless, the Obama administration looks foolish for promising an ample supply of vaccine back in July, a full 100 million doses by October, they said, when only 12 million has been delivered thus far. I'm going to be in Oregon next week and unable to do a podcast, but I will return on Saturday, November 7th. Have a great week.